You're listening to a special presentation brought to you by Radio Free Readout.
She's a disabled Army veteran. She's an attorney. You'll have to forgive her for that, just like you've always forgiven me, and thank you for that. She does the Chris Ann Hall Show and Liberty First. But really, what I love about Chris Ann is she is really dynamic, and she wanted me to actually use this, okay? So I'm going to use this. But she is one kick-ass, cool constitutionalist chick, all right? So let's give her a warm Spokane Valley welcome.
Thank you. See, unlike the other gentleman who couldn't stand up here because he did his head, I have to stand up here so you can see me. Because I'm short. I'm very excited about the news that I've heard here tonight about the success in your elections. I'm very proud of everybody in this room. I was looking at your sign, which this is probably the better Vanna view of this, right? I was looking at your sign and I was thinking, how sad. How sad that you have to distinguish yourselves. The Republican Liberty Caucus. My goodness, because I thought the Republican Party platform in 2012 was the party of the Constitution. And if you profess to be the party of the Constitution, then this phrase must be a given. But I'm proud of you for standing up for what really is right and really true. I don't know how many of you follow me on Facebook or have listened to my radio show or any of that. You know that I have a motto. Liberty over security, principle over party, and truth over personalities. See, one of our greatest afflictions in this country, George Washington actually warned us against in his farewell address. Tried to explain to us that if we became party loyal instead of liberty loyal, if we started worshiping people instead of defending liberty, that would be the very destruction of our republic. And so, when I teach as an attorney, where's my attorney friend? Where are you? Stand up, because you need to know who we are. We are on the endangered species list. We are attorneys that actually understand the Constitution, and we're Christians. That puts us on a really small endangered. I mean, we're more endangered than the spotted owl or this triple striped lizard or something. So you need to make sure that you protect us very closely. One scud, one drone, and you've wiped out half our population. I'm just teasing. But you know, I am very plain spoken. So some things that you're going to hear tonight, well, I'm with the Republican Liberty Caucus, probably not, but some things that you're going to hear tonight might go against what you've thought to be true your whole life. Because we've been taught wrong things for a very, very long time. And that's what I do. Last year, I taught 265 times in 22 states. I teach things that have been taught wrong for a very long time, because if we don't know what liberty is, if we can't define liberty, we can't defend it. And if we can't define tyranny, we can't defeat that either. And the sad news is that tyranny is shining on the faces of some of our beloved personalities, and we don't even recognize it. So I just want to prepare yourselves tonight. We're hearing some things. I'm very plain spoken. My husband teases that I don't have a diplomatic bone in my body. I can be diplomatic if I want to. I just don't think we have time. We need some more people to just start telling the truth and stop dancing around to save people's feelings. I am not politically correct. I call it as I see it. So let's get started, because we've got to learn a lot tonight. Some things that we've been taught that simply are not true. We did not become independent from Great Britain on July 4th, 1776. We became independent from Great Britain on July 2nd, 1776. It was not a rogue act by a bunch of anarchists who didn't like being with the king anymore. Maybe they had too much beer and fish and chips the night before, got up with a headache and said, let's kick this king out. It was a legally binding legislative act. On July 2nd, 1776, the Continental Congress ratified the Lee Resolution. The Lee Resolution was a three-step process to declaring independence from Great Britain. We are, step number one, 13 independent sovereign states. Step number two, as 13 independent sovereign states, we must gather foreign help. Why? Because we just become 13 brand new little bitty countries, and we didn't have the manpower or the resources to kick the most powerful country in the world off our land. So we had to have foreign help. Step number three, we must form a confederation, not a consolidation, a confederation. There's a big difference. Why did we have to form a confederation? Well, because we were going into debt to France, Spain, and Holland. We were going to be occupied by their troops. And you cannot believe that France, Spain, and Holland were helping us with our independence simply because they were a bunch of nice guys. They're looking to get something out of it, and everybody wanted territory in the New World, and if they could assume a territory that's already colonized, woohoo, that'd have been bonus, right? So what happens if France is helping us and they get liking New York? Because it's a little place, it's easy to take over. We think we'll just take this as the payment for our debt. Without a confederation, New York would have to fight off France all by themselves. But with a confederation, we might be able to say to France, hey, you don't go? Not just New York, you've got all 13 of us to deal with. And that's not worth it. They were not ready for all-out war to gain property. So the confederation is what guaranteed the success of our liberty, the success of our independence. Because without the confederation, we'd have been picked off. We'd have been little France, little Spain, little Holland, and probably little pieces of Great Britain once all the negotiation got over with. So the Lee Resolution was ratified on July 2nd, 1776, and John Adams was so excited about it, he wrote a letter to Abigail and said that July 2nd would be an epic day that Americans would celebrate their independence forever. Amen. And then the newspapers published the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. So we're no different than we are today. We believe things in the news before we believe the truth. I'm just teasing. I'm not quite sure why it worked out that way, but it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Another thing that we have to understand that sounds really simple and sort of like a duh moment when you say it out loud, but how many of you have heard this phrase? It's the little foxes that spoil the vine. The little lies that distort the truth. How many of you have ever seen a surveyor on the side of the road? I live in Florida. I live right off Interstate 10. Interstate 10 runs from the coast of Florida all the way to the West Coast. Now, if they're planning to lay out Interstate 10 in a straight line to go from one coast to the other, they've got to make sure those surveyors are on track. And if that surveyor is off by this much in Florida, what's it going to look like in Arizona? You see, we've got to guard the truth in our history, because when it's this much off today, what's it going to look like 20 years from now? So something we need to realize, that we gained our independence from Great Britain on July 2nd, 1776, but on July 1st, 1776, we were all subjects to the crown of Great Britain. Now, I always get argument with them on Facebook about that. You know, we get the liberal trolls that come in and try to do whatever they do, and they say, well, no, we were all from all over the place. We are the melting pot. We've always been the melting pot. Well, that's true, actually, because Thomas Paine writes in his pamphlet, Common Sense, that the benefit that we had in the colonies was that we were from all over. We weren't all just from Great Britain. But once you stepped foot in the colonies, you became subject to British law. So you leave here, and you go to, I don't know, what's the near state here? Idaho. You leave here, you go to Idaho, you're driving down the road, you get pulled over by a police officer. The police officer says, "Do you know why I pulled you over?" And you say, "No, officer, I don't know why you pulled me over. By the way, am I being detained?" Just joking, just seeing who's paying attention. He says, "Well, you broke Idaho law, blah, blah, blah." And you look at him and you say, "Well, that's fine, officer, because I'm not from Idaho." How's that going to work out for you? What if you sell your house in Washington and go buy a house in Idaho? You can't claim citizenship in Washington anymore, can you? Same thing back then. The minute you left from wherever you came, from all over the globe, you stepped foot in the colonies because they were owned by Great Britain, you were subject to British law. And the minute you decided to make your home in the colonies, you became subject to the crown of Great Britain. Because people are always asking me, "Chris Ann, why do you teach British history as the foundation of our Constitution?" Because that's where we came from. If we don't know where we came from, how do we know who we are? If we don't know where our Constitution came from, how do we know it's how it's supposed to work and how we're supposed to apply it and whether we're doing it wrong or right? The courts are getting it all wrong. Why? My friend will back me up here. Because we don't teach the Constitution in law school. We teach constitutional law. Totally different. Constitutional law teaches that men and women in black robes know more about the Constitution than the men who wrote the document. And so you get these people with their progressive Marxist educational system, the socialist takeover of our country, pooling their ignorance. Because after all, we are all so technologically advanced today, that means we're intellectually superior to our framers, and we have to actually tell them what they meant to say because they were too stupid to know any better themselves. Right? Dick Durbin says, "What is press?" He says, "We know Fox, we know AP, we know their press, but are bloggers press? Are tweeters press? We need to ask 21st century questions about a document that was written over 200 years ago." Really? But nobody questions that. There was no outrage in the House or the Senate. There was no major protest over that. Because the majority of the people in our population believe that. That because the document was written 200 years ago, it's somehow outdated, antiquated, irrelevant, because our framers didn't know about Facebook and Twitter. Problem is, the Constitution's not 200 years old. The Constitution and its principles are over almost 1,000 years old. And it's not, your Constitution is not like a statute book that tells you you can't drive more than 75 on the interstate. It's a document of time-tested, blood-bought principles. You will look up that word principle in the dictionary and you'll find out that it's something that cannot be compromised. Because once you compromise it, it's no longer a principle. So we need to know what Patrick Henry said. He says, "I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that's the lamp of experience. I know no way to judge the future but by the past." It's 200 years old, but not outdated, not antiquated, based on 700 years of liberty charters. And they knew what tyranny looked like, so they knew exactly what we would see today. Not Facebook, not Twitter. But they knew that when the government could define liberty, you were already enslaved. That's what the whole word is, shall not be infringed, right? It means absolutely forbidden to violate. Do I have to physically touch you to violate you? Absolutely not. I can say things that violate you. And our framers knew that if our government could just even say things that would interfere with our liberty, that tyranny would have beset us. You ever heard of a guy named Solomon? Said there's nothing new under the sun. We like to say this phrase, those who do not know their history are doomed to repeat it. But that's not quite true. The truth of the matter is, those who do not know their history are doomed to repeat its mistakes, because history always repeats. And before you leave here this evening, I will have you absolutely convinced of that. Because we're going to go see the history that made our Constitution, the history that Patrick Henry and John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington all knew when they gave us a union based on liberty. So we're actually celebrating this year 1,000 years of liberty charters. 1,000 years ago, in February this year actually, the Anglo-Saxons created a limited monarchy. Prior to that, the Anglo-Saxons were doing a really good job of governing themselves. Problem was, they kept getting attacked by foreign kings and foreign kingdoms, and they got tired of trying to pull everybody together and defending themselves. So they went and found this guy named Ethelred. Ethelred's from a powerful family, and they have all this influence in foreign realms. And they said, okay, Ethelred, we will make a contractual agreement with you. We will let you be our king on one condition. We will govern ourselves, and your only job will be foreign affairs. The only job you have is to protect us from foreign invasion and to engage in foreign negotiation. Now, if we were really educated on our Constitution the way we ought to be, we would immediately recognize that that's the very same agreement that we made in the constitutional contract when the states came together and said, we're going to form a union, but in this union, we need to have a central government. And we're going to have this central government with one condition. The states will govern themselves, and the only purpose of the central government is foreign affairs. Never heard that. James Madison tells us about it in Federalist 45. He says, the powers delegated to the federal government are few and defined. Those that remain in the states are numerous and indefinite. The powers delegated to the federal government through the Constitution, he says, are reserved to external objects, foreign affairs. And then he names them war, peace, negotiation, foreign commerce. That is all your central government is entitled and empowered to do. The same agreement that we made with Ethelred in 1014. Two problems with that agreement. You start calling somebody a king, don't be surprised when they start acting like one. Problem number two, you start having a king, don't be surprised when people start acting like subjects. Because it's a matter of human nature. People want to be provided for. They want to get stuff for free. I can get my Obama phone, and I can get my mortgage paid for, and I'll get a free car. Because we want to be taken care of. So they made this agreement with Ethelred, and 30 years later, they've practically got a full 30 years later, they practically got a full-fledged king. His name is Edward the Confessor, and Edward is described in history as being a generous king. Now, I suppose if you're going to have a king, that's the one you want, right? A generous king. So let's talk about that for a minute. When you live in a kingdom, what is your life like? Well, when you live in a kingdom, the king holds all the power, right? And he hands out the rights and the privileges to the people as he sees fit. And if the king is holding all the power and handing out the rights and the privileges, what can he do?
Take them back.
all right, he can take them back. So when you live in a kingdom, you literally wake up every single day wondering what's right and what's wrong. Because what was lawful yesterday might be unlawful today based on the whim of the king. But we don't live in a kingdom, do we? Well, okay, not on paper. Okay. On paper, we are not a kingdom. You know, those 265 times I taught last year, I got to teach on high school and college campuses. I'd ask the young people what kind of government that we have. What do you think the most popular answer was that I got?
Democracy.
Democracy. See, I think if we really understood what a democracy was, we wouldn't simply democracy roll our eyes and shake our head when we know that our young people are being taught that we're a democracy, or when we hear our favorite talking heads on our favorite conservative program call us a democracy, because I've heard it. So we are a constitutional republic, right? We are not a democracy. So let's learn about kingdom, democracy, and constitutional republic. We're going to build a political spectrum. Kingdom over here, because the king holds all the power, hands out the rights and the privileges as he sees fit, he can take them back. Constitutional republic, all the way over here. You can't get any further from a kingdom than a constitutional republic. Why? Because in a constitutional republic, the people hold all the rights and delegate power to the government as they see fit. Does this sound familiar, that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed? And if we hold all the rights and we're delegating power to the government as we see fit, what can we do? See, we need to know that here. Because the distinction between kingdoms and republics is that we are the kings. We take that back. Remember, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. But when a government operates contrary to those means, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish them. I'd rather stick in there the duty.
Hey, I hope you guys are enjoying this Chris Ann Hall presentation talking about the genealogy of the Constitution that was done just this last Thursday, August 7th at 6 p.m. We'll get to that in just a minute. I just wanted to let you know that this other segment with Chris Ann Hall is brought to you by AMP3. You can learn more at amp-3.net. To see some of the medical and specialty gear for the prepared citizen, that they provide high quality products and great supporters of Radio Free Redoubt. So support a partisan and patriot owned business if you get the opportunity. Thank you very much. Okay, back to Chris Ann Hall.
So here we have a kingdom. Here we have a republic. Where does democracy fit on our spectrum? A little closer to a republic, somewhere in the middle. Well, the truth of the matter is, there is no difference between a democracy and a kingdom. The only difference between a democracy and a kingdom is how many people rule over you. In a democracy, it's mob rule. Have you heard that phrase, mob mentality? We have that phrase, mob mentality, because it's a psychological truth that mobs are fickle and stupid. So when we call ourselves a democracy, that means we want to be ruled by stupid, fickle people. But think about that. Congress. Think about that. In the kingdom, the king holds all the power and hands out the rights. He can take them away. In a democracy, the mob holds all the power, hands out the rights as they see fit, and can take them away. Do you know how I know we're not a democracy? If we had been a democracy, Rosa Parks would still be at the back of the bus. Because in a democracy, minorities never have a society-changing voice. That only happens in a constitutional republic where the people have equal representation. So we want to, you know, you keep saying a lie over and over again. It's eventually going to become true. That's another psychological truth. So you want to just roll our eyes and shake our head at being called a democracy and to let it continue. Then we will become a democracy. And that might be fine and dandy. But as long as we're a democracy, you better make sure you're always on the right side of the mob. Because democracies do not bring liberty. The only thing that democracy brings is tyranny and slaves. Now in 1045, Edward is about to die. And he has no heir to the throne. And that's a problem, except every kingdom knows that there's going to be a time when the king doesn't produce an heir. So they make a list of who's next to be king in a situation like that, you know, cousins or whatever. And the guy who's next on the list is a guy named William the First. Now, let me ask you something. You've heard that phrase, it's great to be king. I know you've heard it's great to be president because we're not quite sure the difference between a king and a president these days. But why is it great to be king? Why? Because you get whatever you want. So if you're William the First and you're the next guy on the list to be king, aren't you kind of like waiting for somebody to die? So he's paying really close attention. But there's a problem. Because the people of Great Britain do not want William to be king. Because William's not from Great Britain. William's from Normandy. And imagine this. They don't want a foreign king. So they hatch out this plan to appoint a guy named Harold to be king over Great Britain. Problem is, now we're in 1066, and you don't appoint kings. And William gets wind that he's going to be passed over. Bad news for the people of Great Britain. William has a nickname. He's called William the Conqueror. What do you suppose happens when you make a guy mad whose nickname is the Conqueror? He raises his Norman army. He goes over and defeats Harold and the English people. And declares himself king. Now let me ask you a question. If you live in a kingdom and you're unhappy with your king, do you start a recall petition? Do you find a new king to run against him in the next kingly election? No. What is your only choice if you don't like your king? You start chopping off heads, right? Hey, kings know this. They do. So they're very careful about those types of things. Now, when William gets to Great Britain, he finds out that Great Britain is different than the kingdoms that he's used to. Great Britain is called a limited monarchy. They're still limited from that original agreement from Ethelred because they're limited by common law. Common law says there are some things that are always right and some things that are always wrong, which means there are some things the king cannot change. And William is very unhappy about this. He wants whim. He wants to be completely unlimited. Now, as king, he could step and say, I'm king now. We'll have no more of this common law mess, right? But kings know. You become too tyrannical too fast, you know, heads are going to fly. So instead of stepping up and dissolving common law, William sets out to fundamentally transform Great Britain. Common law, the limitation of the king's power, is the enemy in William's eyes. So the first thing that he does is start replacing the judges in the common law system with judges who are not loyal to the common law, but loyal to the ideology of the king. He starts using those judges to enforce his foreign law on the people of Great Britain, even when it's contrary to their common law. He starts chasing the private landowners off of their land through threat and force, literally running some of them completely out of the kingdom, then taking possession of their land and handing it over to his foreign friends. How else do you keep foreign law in a kingdom if it's not full of people who like the foreign law better than the common law of the land? He starts replacing the leadership in the churches with men who are not loyal to the word of God, but loyal to the ideology of the king, so he can use the churches to tell the people to do things even when those things are contrary to the word of God. This goes on for 40 years through the reign of William I and his son, William II. Now, William II is only going to rule for a short while. He is described in history as being a wicked, evil king. Until one day, William II and his little brother Henry go hunting together. And William II is killed in a mysterious hunting accident when a stray arrow from Henry's hunting party accidentally, mysteriously kills William II, coincidentally catapulting Henry to the throne. Raise your hand if you think this was an accident. But remember, there's nothing new under the sun. Human nature never changes, and the people of Great Britain didn't buy the whole accident story either, which means Henry I knows that the people are questioning his legitimacy on the throne. And when the people question your legitimacy, then you better watch out for your head. So Henry's got to appease the people. So one thing Henry does is he tells the people, this looks really bad, doesn't it? This whole my brother dying thing, you know, I know it makes me look bad, but let me put you at ease. We're going to do an investigation. We're going to investigate whether I'm at fault for the death of my brother or not. We're going to call it a grand tribunal. It'll be three people, not me. How do you think that's going to work out when the government's investigating itself? Like the Department of Justice investigating what? Anyone, right? The conclusions are exactly the same. Henry's not at fault for the death of his brother, but the people don't believe those investigations any more than we do. So Henry's got to keep trying. Now, the next move Henry makes is absolutely brilliant. A very subtle yet brilliant move. See, the majority of the population in Great Britain is still Anglo-Saxon, and Henry is going to promise to marry an Anglo-Saxon woman. What does that mean? That's hard for us to grasp because we haven't been subjects to a king for a long time. But you see, when you're Anglo-Saxon and you have an Anglo-Saxon queen, you have to believe that the crown is going to be sending some good things your way. And in the very least, if hard times fall on Great Britain, as an Anglo-Saxon, you know the queen will never let her people suffer. So Henry and his advisors have figured out the best way to appease the majority of the people is through the expectation of what they're going to get from the government. Because you see, they don't actually have to get it. They just have to expect it. The other thing Henry does is the most important thing. Henry signs the first document in what I call the genealogy of our Constitution. Remember, I told you it took 700 years to write our Constitution. Over those 700 years, there are five liberty charters that had to be written because there is nothing new or novel in our Constitution or our Bill of Rights. Everything in it is inherited. Thomas Jefferson didn't really so much pen the Declaration of Independence as he did plagiarize it from these five documents. And I call them the genealogy because they're that just that important. Like if somebody went back in time and killed my great-great-grandfather, I wouldn't be here. Any one of these five documents not existing, our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, wouldn't be here. And if they did, it would look completely different. And this first document is called the 1100 Charter of Liberties. It's Henry's promise to the people of Great Britain that kings will no longer be evil and oppressive, ever again. And then he makes a list of 14 things that kings can't do, because if they do them, the people will now be on notice that they are being evil and oppressive. Now remember, we're intellectually superior today, right? So if we looked through that list of 14, we would never see anything like that. We're too smart to let something like that happen today, right? How about one? Henry says, if any of my baron or earl shall die. Now the barons and the earls are the landowners. If any my baron or earl shall die, their heirs shall not be forced to purchase their inheritance, but shall retrieve it through force of law and custom. Because Henry knew that when the heirs of an estate had to purchase their estate from the government before they could receive it, that was the mark of an evil and oppressive government. But isn't that what inheritance tax is? Death tax? Don't pay your death tax and find out how much of your inheritance you get, and then you'll actually figure out who owns your stuff, because property ownership is nothing more than an illusion in this country. You possess your property as long as you pay your taxes to the government. But Henry, who didn't have internet, Google, or Facebook, he didn't have CNN or MSNBC or Fox to educate him, knew that inheritance tax was evil and oppressive, and our government calls it revenue. Well, before we give Henry too much credit, Henry's not any more interested in liberty than our government is today. Henry is interested in keeping his head. But the benefit here now is the people have a promise in writing that binds future kings. And they're going to need that, because in 100 years, they're going to have the most evil and oppressive king Great Britain will ever know. His name is John. John is a massive taxation king. And if you cannot pay your taxes in John's kingdom, which is highly likely, you are arrested, you are thrown into prison, you are mutilated. He is cutting off hands, feet, ears, cutting out tongues for not paying your taxes. If you're lucky, you're executed. They said he was ruthless and vicious with his tax collection. You guys know John. Probably don't realize it. Heard a guy named Robin Hood? That's the king in the Robin Hood story. We know Robin Hood because Robin Hood robbed from the rich and gave to the poor. But that's another one of those little lies that we teach. Robin Hood was not robbing from the rich to give to the poor, engaging in redistribution of wealth. Robin Hood was taking from the king and the crown the money that had been stolen from the people through oppressive and unlawful taxation, returning it to the people so they could live. Remember, John's going to murder you if you cannot pay your taxes. Robin Hood's not trying to put people on equal financial footing. He's giving people their lives back. He's not a socialist. He's a liberty fighter. Because the first step to liberty is always a right to life. Well, something else we learn about people and governments through John's reign: murdering people for not paying your taxes is not enough to bring a revolution. Because you see, when societies, history proves this, when societies are only focused on prosperity, only focused on stuff, provision, what they have or what they can get, tyrants will always be able to trickle down just enough stuff to make you a happy slave. See, we don't go to war over taxes. We go to war over liberty. Well, John, good news is kings always commit fundamental errors. Tyrants eventually get so power drunk that they think they can do anything and the people will never stand up. John's fundamental error is this: the people of Great Britain have chosen a man by the name of Stephen Langton to be their archbishop, the head of their church. John says, I don't like this guy. I'm going to pick who the head of your church is going to be. But you see, John's already forgotten about the 1100 Charter of Liberties. Because the very first promise Henry makes, it's not even in the list of 14, it's in the opening paragraph. The very first promise he makes is that the church will be completely free from government intrusion. That's the definition of separation of church and state, by the way. And Thomas Jefferson didn't invent it. He just simply remembered it from his history lesson. That's what religious liberty is, when the government is not in your church. That's the first aspect of our First Amendment, isn't it? Okay, so now we're going to have a pop quiz. Which means you can't use your smartphones, you can't look at your pocket constitutions. This is such a pop quiz, I don't even want you to answer out loud. I don't even want you to mumble or lip sync the answer. Because I don't want your neighbor to know whether you know the answer. I want them to know whether they know the answer. Are you ready? There are five individual liberties in the First Amendment alone. To yourself, name all five. We have a Supreme Court justice in Florida who took a poll and asked that question. Found out only 2% of the people asked could name all five. So I'm sure there are people in this room who can only name four. I'm pretty sure there's people in this room who can only name three. Now, where you fall in that statistic is none of my business. That's why I didn't want you to answer out loud. But I asked you that question just so I could ask you this one. If you don't know what your rights are, how do you know they're not already gone? We talk about constitutional rights. There's no such thing. The Constitution does not give you rights. Your rights belong to you because you breathe. We talk about constitutional protection of your rights. That's not true either. The Constitution can't protect your rights. It's a piece of paper with ink on it. Can the Constitution write your representative a letter? Can the Constitution go sit in your senator's office and demand compliance? Can the Constitution pick up a sword when it's time to alter or abolish, as Jefferson forewarned? Of course not. Because the truth of the matter is, the only defender of your liberty is sitting in your seat right now. And if you don't know your rights, they're already gone. A revolution comes against John, bringing us the second document in the genealogy of our Constitution. It's called the Magna Carta. Now, I'm fairly certain the majority of the people in this room have heard of the Magna Carta. I'm also fairly certain the majority of the people in this room have never heard of the 1100 Charter of Liberties, unless you've heard me teach before. Because the truth of the matter is, even our best constitutional studies, if they go beyond 1776, which is rare, they stop at the Magna Carta, but we miss a very, very important step in the defense of liberty. Remember who wrote the 1100 Charter of Liberties? Henry I. Who wrote the Magna Carta? The people. It is 1215. These people are still subjects to a crown. They have no rights, no privileges unless the king says so. But now they're getting a better grasp of liberty, what it's worth, and the price taken needed to keep it. And they stand up to the king now and say, hey, you made us a promise in 1100 that kings would no longer be evil and oppressive. You obviously have no idea how to keep that promise. So now we, the people, are going to rise in our majesty and place ourselves above the king and tell the king what he can and cannot do so he will keep his promise. No taxation without representation. Creating a committee of 25 men who will sit in the king's court with the power and the authority to tell the king, no, you can't do that because it violates your promise. So many things come from the Magna Carta. Our 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th amendments come from clauses 38 through 41 in the Magna Carta. We didn't invent them, we inherited them. Clause 61 of the Magna Carta carries a number of our unalienable rights. One of them being the right to petition the government for a redress of our grievances. That should sound familiar. That's that fifth aspect of the First Amendment that everybody always forgets. So if you got four, that's the one you probably forgot because we don't use those words anymore. So let's go through the First Amendment real quick in a real simple, easy way. Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom to assemble, and the freedom to complain. That's what it means, the right to petition the government for a redress of your grievances. You have a right to complain about your government, and they cannot prosecute you or persecute you for it. And we didn't invent it. We inherited it when people in a kingdom stood up against a king. Now, John signs the Magna Carta because he's got a sword at his throat, and the people remove him from the throne. But now people have the power to tell the king no. Now you have to realize that's not going to go over well with kings. So for the next 400 years, they're literally going to have to fight with kings to maintain this control. So what we're going to do right now is fast forward. 1625. The king's name is Charles I. Charles is described as being a massive spending king. They say Charles loves to romp about Europe, spending on his every whim and fancy. I don't know if they played golf back then or not, but it'd be interesting to know. Whose money was Charles spending? The people's. How was he collecting their money? Taxes. Now, the problem is this committee of 25 men is now called Parliament. And Parliament gets sick and tired of Charles' wasteful spending and looks at Charles and says, "We're not passing any more of your laws until you get your spending under control." Novel idea, huh? Charles says, "Okay, fine. But wait a minute. I'm king. Why do I need Parliament?" And he dissolves Parliament. Now, did he have to physically remove Parliament from the court? Could he have said, "Where Parliament refuses to legislate, I'll just go ahead and regulate"? Could he have held a State of the Kingdom address and said, "If Parliament will not pass laws, I will. After all, I have a quill and a messenger"? Isn't that the same as dissolving Parliament, declaring them irrelevant and impotent, and if they go along with it, then they really are, aren't they? Well, Charles knows that if he's too tyrannical too fast, they'll chop off his head. He wants to keep collecting the people's money, but he can't pass a tax. So Charles remembers that kings have a unique power called the power of decree. He can issue a decree on the people that is legally binding without Parliament. Now, he issues a decree to collect the people's money, but he's careful. He doesn't call it a tax. He calls it a forced loan. It's not a tax. Don't worry. I'm not passing this through the wrong body. This is not a tax. This is a mandate. The people protest. Five knights stand up to Charles and say, We are not enforcing this tax, and we are not going to comply either. Charles throws them in prison, denies them their due process, because we didn't invent that. And a revolution is born, bringing the third document in the genealogy of our Constitution. This one's called the Petition of Right of 1628. The Petition of Right of 1628 is a list of grievances, according to Section 61 of the Magna Carta, on how Charles has violated the Magna Carta and broken the promise in the 1100 Charter of Liberties. There'll be no taxation without representation, regardless of what you call it. Yes, we do have a right to due process, and while we're making a list, we're going to add a few more things that the people have in liberty. Number one, you cannot invoke martial law on us unless we're being invaded by a foreign nation, and you cannot quarter soldiers in our homes, because we didn't invent the Third Amendment either. Charles signs the Petition of Right the same way John did, with a sword at his throat. But this time, the people do not remove John or Charles from the throne like they did John. Maybe they thought Charles had learned his lesson. How do you think that's going to work out for him? Well, actuality, Charles learned a lesson. Charles learned that if I'm going to take the people's money, I can't just whim and fancy it. I've got to have a really good excuse. And good thing for Charles is the years between 1628 and 1641 give Charles the perfect excuse. Because the years between 1628 and 1641 are very violent times in Europe. There are wars everywhere. And Charles comes to his people and says, "Hey, you see that over there? Look at all those awful, horrible wars over there. Do you want that war to come to Great Britain? Of course you don't want that war to come to Great Britain. I have the perfect plan to keep that war from ever coming to Great Britain. All you have to do is give me your tax dollars. And I will make sure that all our allies are adequately funded in all these foreign wars. And if our allies have all the funding and all the provision they need, then of course they'll be victorious. They will win those wars over there, so the wars will never come over here. So all you have to do is give me your tax dollars. It's a matter of national security that you give me your tax dollars. But you see, 1628 was a big year. And the people are watching Charles really closely. And they're noticing something about Charles. Charles is not funding their allies. Charles is funding their enemies. Because the enemies have made a deal with Charles to help him get the people of Great Britain back under subjection. None of this is sounding familiar, right? Charles is brought up on charges of treason. Found guilty and sentenced to death. Bringing the fourth document in the genealogy of our Constitution, it's called the Grand Remonstrance of 1641. The Grand Remonstrance of 1641 is another list of grievances, and it's a really, really amazing document. It reads, "The root of all this mischief we find to be a malignant and pernicious design subverting the fundamental laws and liberties of our kingdom." So what does that mean in modern English? It means we've been watching tyrants for 600 years and we're starting to notice a pattern. The same bag of tricks over and over and over again. A wicked, evil plan whose only purpose is to overturn and undermine liberty. Here's the plan, according to the Grand Remonstrance of 1641. Corruption of the court system, infiltration of foreign law, the government diminishing the property rights of the people, the government taking over the churches, the government creating fiat money so they can manipulate the economy, and the government disarming the people while the government remained armed. The malignant and pernicious design as identified in 1641, because those who do not know their history are doomed to repeat its mistakes. Are you guys familiar with Agenda 21? Okay. You'd be surprised to know the United Nations did not invent sustainable development. Go read the Grand Remonstrance of 1641, and if you know sustainable development, you will recognize sustainable development and the grievances of the people. But you will come across two grievances, same thought, but two different grievances. Charles, they say, and this was treason, by the way, was taking the private land from the landowners in the name of resource preservation, and I quote, depopulation. He was attempting to take them off the gold and silver standard by creating brass fiat money, and in 1641, they called that treason and chopped off his head. Don't get too excited. 40 years later, they got a brand new king, and they're starting all over again. This king's name is James II. James, you see, the only people that don't know their history are the subjects and the slaves. The tyrants always learn from their mistakes. And James has figured out that when we engage in the malignant and pernicious design and take things from the people, as long as we can give them stuff, they'll never even notice. So don't pay attention to what we're taking from you over here. We're giving this to you over here. And James issues a decree for the people, and he calls this decree religious liberty. I'm going to give you something you've never had before. I'm going to give you religious liberty. And the religious liberty decree says you can have church anywhere you want, with any pastor you want. You can preach anything you want, anytime you want. And the government cannot persecute you or prosecute you. Religious liberty. But then he says, before you have church, the decree says, you must inform the king where you're meeting, when you're meeting, who will be preaching, what will be said. And you must promise that you will never, ever, ever say anything that might even be construed as a criticism of the king. Punishable by death. See, that doesn't sound like religious liberty to me. That sounds like a 501c3.
This is John Jacob Schmidt, and you're listening to a special presentation that was done this last Thursday by Chris Ann Hall in the Spokane Valley on August 7th. This next segment is brought to you by Katie Armor. They sell level 3 body armor, and this is AR-500 frag-coated top-of-the-line equipment with plates and carriers, including front and back and side plates for your tactical protection. Go ahead and check them out at katiearmor.com. Don't forget, you can also contact us if you have any questions, comments, or anything like that about Radio Free Redoubt. Contact me at johnjacob@radiofreeredoubt.com. We'll turn this over to Chris Ann Hall, and then I'll wrap everything up as soon as this is over. So stand by. This is the Voice of the American Redoubt.
Seven bishops stand up to James and say, "We have a promise over 500 years old that says the government will stay out of our church. We are not following your decree." James throws them in prison, charges them a crime called seditious libel. That's the aspect you can't criticize the king. Now, James has learned from Charles, you got to give them their day in court or they'll chop off your head. But James has nothing to fear, because the crime of seditious libel is written in such a way that truth is no defense. So even if you're correct in your criticism of the king, you have to die. So seven bishops got their day in court. And seven bishops, who should have been guilty for the law, were acquitted, because two judges refused to enforce an unconstitutional decree, and the rest had a jury of their peers who refused to find them guilty of an unconstitutional crime. Because we didn't invent the jury of our peers, and we didn't invent jury nullification. We inherited them. A revolution is brought against James, called the Glorious Revolution of 1688. It was called the Glorious Revolution because they said hardly a shot was fired. James got so scared, he got on his horse and rode away. But we get the fifth document in the genealogy of our Constitution. This one's called the English Bill of Rights of 1689. The English Bill of Rights of 1689 says, "The late King James II, by the assistance of evil judges, counselors, and ministers employed by him," because even James had czars, "did endeavor to subvert and extirpate the laws and liberties of our kingdom." Now, I had no idea what that word extirpate meant. I'm sure there's smart people in here that know that, but I had to look it up in the dictionary. And that word extirpate means to completely destroy. Now, when you completely destroy something, there is nothing left. And they said James was completely destroying liberty. And they gave a whole list of reasons why. You should go look at that list. I'm sure you won't find any familiar. I'm going to share one with you just because it helps us understand where we are. They said James was completely destroying liberty by writing law, overturning law, and setting aside law when that was a power reserved to Parliament alone. See, we didn't invent separation of powers. We inherited it. And in 1688, they had separation of powers. They had three branches of government, just like us. They had an executive branch and the king. They had a legislative branch in Parliament and a judicial branch. And they said, when these branches are separate and distinct, they cannot share power and they cannot steal power. And when that happens, that is the complete destruction of liberty. So if in fact we are intellectually superior to the people of 1688, how is it that a people who are dumber than we are and still subjects to a king figured out that executive orders were the complete destruction of liberty, and today our Congress does nothing? Oh, wait, my bad. We're going to sue the president. We're going to sue him. Do you know what's funny about that? Nothing. Everybody's really mad at John Boehner for wanting to sue the president. But you know what? It wasn't his idea first. It was Trey Gowdy's idea first. Trey Gowdy put forward the legislation so that they could do this. It's called the Enforce the Law Act. So we're ready to jump down Boehner's throat. Why wasn't anybody willing to criticize Trey Gowdy when he said the exact same thing? See, we gotta recognize tyranny no matter who's wearing it on their head. We got to get over this cult of personality worship. I'm not saying Trey Gowdy did this because he was evil. I'm saying he did this because he's ignorant. Now let me make a distinction, because somebody gets offended when I use that word ignorant. Ignorant doesn't mean stupid. Ignorant means you lack information. And apparently Trey Gowdy lacks some very important information with his Enforce the Law Act. So let's think about this for just a second. The proposal is, we're going to sue the president, where? In federal court. Who appoints federal judges? The executive branch. So Congress thinks we're going to sue the president in a court stacked with his judges, and we're going to get something out of that. Yeah, we are going to get something out of that, the complete destruction of our Constitution. And the permanent establishment of a totalitarian kingdom. Because you see, our courts don't work on the Constitution anymore. They work on precedent. And these judges will say, is what our president doing now, is what he's doing now different than any other thing that any other president has done? And the courts will say, no. He's not doing anything different than the other presidents have done. And therefore, he's not violating separation of powers. And now, our Congress will have put the nail in the coffin because they will have allowed the courts to justify this destruction. And then what happens? One of three things. We simply lay prostrate before the courts and declare themselves the oligarchy that rules over us. Or we do what we should have done in the first place. The states start nullifying these unconstitutional federal laws. Congress starts disarming, defunding, and dissolving these unconstitutional agencies through Article 1, Section 7. And they start impeaching under Article 2, Section 4. But that's not likely going to happen. Because we've been infested with federal supremacists who believe that once the court bangs the gavel, then that's the last word. Or what's the third option that's left? Revolution. That's a dirty word. We don't want to say that. But you know what? Our framers said we had a right to revolution. We have a right to protect our life, our liberty, and our property. You know what the brilliance of our framers was? They didn't create a kingdom. They wanted Washington to be king. How many of you know that after the Revolution, people were begging George Washington to be king? Why can't we have men like Washington again who are willing to not be king? Well, if we want to lay blame, I better start passing out some mirrors. Because you are your school system, you are your local government, and you are Congress. Remember, government only has power by the consent of the governed. And consent comes from action and inaction. Well, interesting bit of trivia. We have presidents who exert more power than kings. Because the last executive order written by a king of Great Britain was James II in 1688. 70 years later, brand new king ruling over the people of Great Britain. You know him. His name is George III. Because remember, we were all subjects to the crown of Great Britain. And although we like to teach our young people that the Boston Tea Party was about taxes, We've already learned this evening that people do not go to war with their own government over taxes. So there must have been something more to it. And here's what it is. Great Britain had gone into great debt defending the colonies in the French and Indian War, and then decided that the colonists should have to pay back that debt all by themselves. Now, that doesn't sound unreasonable to us because we're not colonists. But you see, when you're a colonist, that means your rights, your privileges, and your responsibilities are no different than any other person in the kingdom, no matter where they live. So if we have to defend colonies in India or South Africa, everybody in the kingdom shares that responsibility because everybody in the kingdom shares in the prosperity that comes from the colonies. And the colonists said, wait a minute, you're sharing in all the prosperity that we have in this enormously prosperous land. Why do we have to pay for that alone? And then they said, these laws, not these taxes, these laws that you keep passing on us are being done without our representation in Parliament. Now, Parliament's got a totally different perspective, right? Government always had a different perspective than the people. And they tell the colonists, don't be ridiculous. Of course you have representation in Parliament. We have people in Parliament who have volunteered to represent your interests. The colonists said, wait a minute. If they're over there on the island making laws to be enforced over here, and they never have to come over here and live under those laws, those people do not represent us. Do you see what they're trying to teach us? That when the people who make the laws can exempt themselves from the enforcement of those laws, those people do not and cannot represent you. Well, the colonists had no representation, so Parliament didn't hear their plea. So they started in collecting a taxes to pay back this debt. These taxes came in the form of consumption taxes. We know them as sales taxes. So a consumption tax, taxes on items and goods that you consume. And these taxes were placed on linen, lumber, sugar, tea, paper, and ink. All these things that the colonists had to have to get by in their daily lives. But then Parliament had a brilliant idea. We can maximize our revenue from these consumption taxes by mandating that the colonists purchase the taxed items. And if they fail to purchase the taxed items, we will throw them in prison and transport them to Quebec to be tried for these offenses. Now, no law is any good unless you can have enforcement, of course, right? So in order to enforce this law, because the colonists weren't volunteering to have their businesses and their homes searched, they passed a law called writs of assistance. Writs of assistance is what we call in the legal field a handwritten warrant, which means there's no judicial review whatsoever. It literally is that. The agent writes the warrant on your doorstep and serves it to you. No due process whatsoever. So these warrantless searches, resulting in unlawful searches and seizures, the arresting of the people, and the transporting them to Canada to be tried. See, the Boston Tea Party was not about taxes. It was the East India Trading Company tea that they threw over the side, not by random selection or accident, but on purpose. Because it was the East India Trading Company tea that was the mandated tea. We did not go to war over taxes. We went to war over legislation without representation, warrantless searches, denial of due process, mandated purchases, and foreign courts and foreign law. They weren't yelling taxed enough already. They may have been yelling tyrannized enough already. So when Thomas Jefferson sat down to pen the Declaration of Independence, you will see it looks just like the English Bill of Rights, the Grand Remonstrance, and the Petition of Rights, because it's another list of grievances against the king on how he has violated their liberty charters and broken his promise in the 1100 Charter of Liberties. We have a lot to learn about liberty. John Adams said, liberty must be supported at all hazards. Notice he didn't say healthcare. And he didn't say national security either. But he didn't say Medicaid or Social Security. He said liberty. Liberty must be supported at all hazards. He says we have a right to it derived from our maker. How many of you have heard of this principle called natural law? Natural law teaches we are created in the image of God, and because we're created in the image of God, we've inherited certain things from God. One thing that we've inherited from God is freedom. God's the most ultimate free being in the universe. Raise your hand if it's your job to wake up every day and tell God how to run things. Most of the time, the men look at their wives because that's, you know, that's what they think we do all day long. We tell God how to run things, but that's not it. We've inherited the freedom, not the wisdom or the power. But we don't want to live in a country where people are free. That sounds shocking. But we don't want to live where there's freedom alone. Because if we live on a country where there's freedom alone and we build a country on freedom, that means I'm free to lie, I'm free to steal, and I'm free to murder. I am free to do whatever I want to do regardless of how that hurts you. And that's not liberty. That's anarchy. Freedom is an aspect of liberty. They're not synonymous. Liberty is freedom plus morality. That shared morality that says, I recognize that I am free to lie and I'm free to steal and I am free to murder, but I will not because it's wrong. I'm going to tell you something to make your legislators mad. Laws don't stop crimes. I spent over a decade in the criminal justice system, and I can tell you the criminal justice system was not invented to stop crimes. The criminal justice system was invented to identify criminal activity and set up a mechanism to punish criminals. Because there are only two things that will stop someone from doing something bad. I am free to murder my neighbor anytime I want to. So are you. Now you'll suffer the consequences for doing that, but you are free to do that. But you see, you are free to murder your neighbor anytime you want to, but you will not because it's wrong. Morality. You are free to murder your neighbor anytime you want to, but you will not because he's well armed. Force. There are only two things that stop people from doing bad things: morality and force. But when we become an immoral people, and the more immoral we come, the more we cry out to government to keep us safe from ourselves. Keep us safe from ourselves, oh government. And the government's more than happy to do that. Because in order for the government to keep you safe from yourself, you must give the government more power. And the more power government has to protect you, the less liberty you have. Liberty. We have a right to it derived from our maker. But John Adams said, if we had not, our fathers have bought and purchased it for us with their ease, their estates, their pleasure, and their blood. I don't know what your faith is in this room, but you cannot deny that men and women came before us and gave us the right to sit here today. Say a prayer and complain about the government and not worry about stormtroopers coming through the door. Liberty is not a gift that you purchase for yourself. The liberty is a gift that you have to pay forward. But the liberty that we squander today is not our own either. It belongs to ages and millions yet unborn. Samuel Adams said, if we tamely suffer a lawless attack on liberty, we encourage it, and we involve others in our doom. He said it should take serious consideration and reflection that millions yet unborn will be the miserable sharers of our experience. See, I 265 times in 22 states means I'm away from my family on average 3 weeks out of every month. I have an 8-year-old at home. I have a husband at home. We do this because we want our son to have liberty. I don't charge any speaking fees. I don't require any groups to compensate me for my travel, my rental car, my hotel, or anything about what I do. And I don't tell you that to pat myself on the back. I tell you that because I bet you can think of at least 3 people who should have been sitting in this room with you today. I bet you can think of at least 2 groups that you are personally associated with that would benefit from this teaching lesson. And because it won't charge you a dime, it won't cost you a dime to schedule me, there are no excuses. See, it won't cost you anything. But what will it cost us to be ignorant? Samuel Adams said, when a people become universally ignorant and debauched in their manners, they will sink underneath their own weight without the aid of foreign invaders. We have become so universally ignorant as to the liberty, what it is, the cost of it, and our obligation to future generations, that we've almost become irreversibly negligent. Do you realize that we have adults who know nothing from the day they were born but government regulation? From the milk and the cereal that they eat in the morning to the bed and the sheets that they sleep in at night. Every aspect of your life is now regulated by the government, and the EPA now regulates the air that you breathe. But what's even worse than that, right? We are now raising up a generation of people, a new generation of people, who are comfortable with government surveillance. The government should be able to read our emails and listen to our phone conversations. We need to have cameras on every street corner and on every building to keep us safe. And the kids that we have now, that's going to be everyday practice for them. Nothing new. And when you become comfortable in your tyranny, you're a subject and you don't even know it. Did I teach you something? History repeating itself, isn't it? Let me mention to you, I didn't come here to teach you. I didn't come here to entertain you. I came here to recruit you. We don't need people who are willing to come to meetings and sit on chairs. We need people who are willing to become part of a Liberty First brigade and fight. Because the children are worth it. The days of sitting and complaining at the television and the radio are over. It is time for some winter soldiers and some rainy day patriots to stand up and say, I will fight for liberty. I will defend the liberty that belongs to ages yet unborn. Consequences come what may. Because the price of liberty has not changed, and neither has the consequences of our negligence. So people ask me, Chrisanne, what is your motivation? Let me just confess something to you. I have down days. I have days where I get discouraged. I have days where my husband posts pictures on Facebook of all the memories that my son is making and I'm not a part of them. And I wonder why. Why am I doing this? What are we doing here? What impact are we having? And then I remember, I remember because I see your young people and I'm reminded why. I'm reminded of Jesse. I sound like a politician now, right? Jesse. I was in Lyle this week. Jesse is a 16-year-old young man who heard me teach earlier this year. Jesse organized and coordinated for me to come to his town and teach. A 16-year-old young man put together a meeting for his community all by himself. And I asked him, why, Jesse? Why did you do that? He said, because what I learned from you seemed so important. I thought that if my community could learn this too, my community would be a better place to live in. Because you see, this education is inspirational because it's all about liberty. I would say if you're under the age of 22, 25, stand up right now. I know there's some people in here that age. Stand up. Come on, I'm looking at you. I won't pick on you too much. How old are you? Come in here now. All right, well, there you go. See, now look. This is the face that you should see every single day. Remember, Sam Adams said, if we tamely suffer a lawless attack on liberty, we encourage it, and we involve others in our doom. See, I walk through your towns. I see your people all over the country, your young people. I lock eyes with them, and I think, what have I done today to defend their liberty? Because if I come across a day where I can say, well, you know, I really didn't do much, then on that day, according to Sam Adams, I became a cheerleader for the tyranny that would bind and enslave them. Because the price is eternal vigilance. John Philip Curran said, it is the common fate of the indolent to see their rights taken by the active. The condition upon which God grants liberty to man is eternal vigilance. And if that condition be broken, servitude is his punishment and the immediate indication of his guilt. Eternal vigilance doesn't give us time to be couch potatoes. It means we have a responsibility. And I'll leave you with a quote, because I'm here to recruit you. I'll leave you with a quote from Winston Churchill. If you will not fight for the right when you can easily win without bloodshed, if you will not fight when the victory is sure and not too costly, you may have to fight with all the odds against you and only a precarious chance of survival. But he said there may even be a worse case. You may have to fight when there is no hope. Because it's better to perish than to live as a slave. You and I will never see that last consequence, I don't believe. I know history, and I know history repeat how history repeats. But we will condemn that fate on future generations if we don't start fighting back now. And we don't have to chop off heads. We have solutions. We have plans. We just have to get educated. So I want to ask you, what do you want your legacy to be? Because that's the question here tonight. What do you want your legacy to be? Alexander Hamilton said, I've done my duty. I've warned you of the dangers. But if you insist on marching on to your own destruction, you'll have no excuses. Your consciences will reproach you, and your children's children will curse you. Is that the legacy that you want? Or do you want the legacy that says, we were the generation that stood, life, fortune, sacred honor, so that our children could be free? I want to thank, if you had anything to do with the planning of this meeting, please stand up. Don't be shy, just stand up. All right, you need to give them a hand, please. Because they do what I cannot. I am not an organizer. I'm a rabble rouser. I come and stir the pot and leave them with the mess. So I'm going to hand the microphone over to one of them and say thank you very much for your time.
You're listening to a special presentation brought to you by Radio Free Readout.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for sticking with us. And thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this great message by a great patriot, attorney, a constitutional lawyer, Chris Ann Hall. I want to encourage you to listen to her podcast that will be airing in the pre-broadcast every Sunday afternoon on Radio Free Readout. And if you actually want to hear more, you can go over to her podcast at libertyfirst.com and listen to that. And she's got some great materials, books, and things like that. So you can learn, so you can equip yourself. I want to remind you also that the 15th is the deadline for the Amron Core Charter membership. It will go up from $25 to $40 annual membership on the 15th. The 15th is the last day. All right, and that's pretty much all I have for you guys. Okay, you have a blessed week this week. We got lots to do. We're going to be working hard for you guys to try to make this T-Rex 2014 a good learning experience for each of our families, and also a good experience for you and all the communications operators that will be working hard to try to keep information flowing throughout the exercise so we can be prepared in a real-world situation. All right, guys, God bless, and may the Lord go with all of you. For episode 1431, I'm John Jacob Schmidt. This is the voice of the American Redoubt. Good night.